Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with playwright Mafoniso Udofia about the world premiere of her play In Old Age at the Magic Theater in San Francisco's Fort Mason, the fifth installment of her nine-part series of plays, which tells the story of multi-generational families of Nigerian immigrants and their American-born children. I'll talk with Rachel Rosen, the director of programming at SF Film, about the 2019 San Francisco International Film Festival, which opens on April 10th and runs through the 23rd in venues around the Bay Area. Also talk with award-winning director and producer Sarah Dosa, whose documentary The Seer and the Unseen premieres during the festival. I'll have a conversation, pre-recorded, with choreographer Alonzo King and Emmy Award-winning Vietnamese musician and composer Van Ein, Vanessa Vo, who collaborate for the first time to create a new work that draws from global traditions and pushes the boundaries of their respective disciplines. Performances are at the Yerba Buena Center for the Performing Arts, April 12th through the 21st. From Oakland-based theater company Ragged Wing, I'll talk with artistic director Amy Sass, who wrote and directs the original new play Time Sensitive, a fantastical tale that combines clockwork choreography, rhythmic fugue, and melting ice art in collaboration with climate artist Carter Brooks, who also joins me in studio. And a chat with Brett Strader, artistic director of the Sing for America Foundation, about the Sing for America benefit concert this coming Sunday evening, with guest diva Debbie Voigt, as well as the SFA chorus and orchestra. Stay with us. It's a pleasure to welcome to our open airwaves Mafoniso Udofia, whose play In Old Age is enjoying a world premiere run at the Magic Theater in Fort Mason through the 21st of this month. It's the fifth installment of Udofia's nine-part series of plays in which she tells the multi-generational stories of a family of Nigerian immigrants and their American-born children. Mafoniso is a first-generation Nigerian-American storyteller and educator. She attended Wellesley College and obtained her MFA in acting from ACT here in San Francisco. During her stay in the Bay Area, she co-pioneered the groundbreaking youth theater initiative, the NIA Project, which provided artistic outlets for youth residing in the Bayview Hunters Point District. Udofia is also currently at work on a commission from the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, translating Shakespeare's Othello through its Play On program, something we'll have to talk about. Her plays have been developed and presented and produced by theater groups all over the map, and she was the recipient of the 2017-18 McKnight National Residency and Commission at the Playwright Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Welcome, Mafoniso.
Hello, welcome.
Forgive my voice. I'll try to keep this interview you talking more than I will. Mm-hmm. So this is number five of a nine-part mega project. The fourth installment of the cycle, Her Portmanteau, is currently part of a special collaboration with ACT at the Strand Theater through the 14th. So two of your works simultaneously here in the San Francisco Bay Area.
You're right. It's a humbling honor to see two works go up with two institutions I really love.
Well, Magic Theater has been an important nurturer for you as well.
That's correct. I think our relationship, if I'm remembering dates well, began in 2013, where they had me come in for their Virgin Play Reading Festival. And that's where they learned of me, and then also the first installation of the cycle, Sojourners. And then after that, I came back and did some readings of the third, Run Boy Run. And then the artistic director gives me a call, I want to say a couple months later, and is like, we want to program two, both of them. And I was like, I think you're a little crazy. And she's like, okay. And I was like, okay, let's do this. And so
it's hard to say no to something like that.
No, it is very hard to say no to something like that.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
What compelled you to write a nine-part saga like this?
I didn't start out with nine. I started out with one. I wrote...
I think that was my mother's line, too. I'm the youngest of seven.
Exactly.
Started out with one.
One sounds good. Let me get one done. And I was really interested in the formation of the Nigerian body here in the United States, specifically for the play that I was writing, the very first one, The Grove, I was looking at what it was to self-identify when you're from a communal culture. And so I wrote that play and then became fascinated by the people who made the girl who was having these questions, which meant then I suddenly had to start writing the parents. And then in writing the parents, that became a trilogy. I wanted to follow them over the arc of their life. So then it became a 5-part series. And then I wanted to touch back on the children specifically because these are Black folks who don't have a transatlantic Black narrative. And so I was really interested in how race plays out on a body that doesn't carry that history. So I wanted to take a look at the children. Hmm. And then I was like, 9 is enough. I have to put a period at the end of it at some time.
Right. Well, give us the storyline of In Old Age.
So In Old Age, we are taking a look at Abasiyama Ufot, and she's the matriarch of the cycle. And when I first started writing, I thought that I was going to be writing about the man who's the patriarch, and it actually quickly became her cycle fast. So with her, I'm looking at what it is for her to clean out her house. This is a woman who has been abused, and ask myself, after years, decades of abuse, how does one love again? And what does it take to love healthily when the greater part of your history has been one of abuse? So that's what I'm looking at with Abasiyama. And she's doing this in her old age, which is the point in time where I think a lot of people are like, I'm set in my ways. This is how it's going to be. And not for Abasiyama. She cleans her house and loves at the end of her life.
Hmm. What was the casting process like then for this?
Oh, the casting for any of my shows is really difficult because I write a lot in EBBO. I am also really physically demanding for folks of a certain age. And so we cast Stephen Anthony Jones, who is a San Francisco stalwart out here. He's a fantastic actor. And he is closer to the appropriate age. And for Abasiyama, we went with Nancy Morissette, who is closer to my age mate, but really has transformative power and can do the physical demands of the show.
And I'm understanding you're using these plays sort of as an opportunity to counter the basic ignorance of Americans of when they think of Africa as a country rather than a continent.
They sure do, yes. I mean, even if you pay attention to what happens in airlines, it's like we service India, China, and Africa. And you're like, oh, wow. No, where in Africa are we?
Like, what, 500 languages alone in Nigeria?
Exactly. So whatever we can do to counterbalance that and also disrupt part of the immigrant, the narrative we have for immigrants here in America, that immigrants come and only want to stay, as opposed to certain immigrants who have no intention of staying there. And that was particular for Nigerian immigrants. They didn't want to stay.
Hmm. You also mentioned in an interview that how correcting the notion that not all immigrants coming to this country are fleeing
exactly.
Something negative.
Exactly. There's an interesting thing that happens, especially when we are, there's a particular xenophobic way that we take a look at immigrants and the way we...
More so since in the past couple of years, unfortunately.
Exactly. Where we are assuming they're always in active flight or under oppression from the nation states that they're coming from, or that they're here to siphon off of America. There are many nuanced different kinds of immigrant stories, and for some reason we are more legible within a refugee story.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the story or saga of immigration to America has sadly taken on a very different tone mm-hmm. in the current administration, which almost seems to want to build a wall around the Statue of Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
Has that influenced how you're presenting these stories or how you're moving forward?
I started writing in 2009, which was pre Trump pre this administration, which has brought a lot of these issues to a head. I do think, however, that questions of xenophobia are it's part of an American fabric. So even though we are more conscious of it now, people who have been living in these immigrant bodies have known of it for a long time. So for me, this has always been salient, and it's very interesting to see the era that we're in like drive these issues forward so that they're now part of common discussion. So it hasn't necessarily changed it for me, but it definitely makes the way they're consumed happen in a different light.
Hmm. And I understand that when you were in New York, that you're taking auditions, 4 or 5 auditions a week as Actors Zoo, and at times you were told that you weren't African enough. How did you interpret that? And welcome to the stereotypes of central casting.
Oh, my Lord, I don't know. It was interesting to be an African woman. What it was I am full, I am plush, I'm articulate, I don't fit into any of the poverty porn narratives that I think a lot of people want to place on top of an African body. And I also come from, like, Nigeria had the biggest war, the Biafran War, the first modern African war. And emaciation looks different on different bodies. And so I remember what it was to go out for a play like Ruined and be told, you're thick, we're looking at war stories. And I would look at my aunts or my uncles and think about what wartime was for them, and their bodies held a certain kind of strength in body through the suffering. So I was like, what is it that you have inside of your head about what an African body must perform like? Hmm. And I never really fit the mold.
And now, as a first-generation Nigerian-American, mm-hmm. what is your connection to Nigeria and to Africa, personally?
Well, I grew up in mini Nigeria in my household, even though I grew up in Houston, Texas. My parents kept me very contained. I tell stories that I don't think I had, like, hamburgers and pasta and things like that until later, like middle school. I was eating fufu and with soup. And so for me, Nigeria really is home. But interesting, when you go to Nigeria, when I was younger, I also understood where and how I was different. So I live in like a dynamic half land that I think a lot of first generation immigrants understand.
Well, thank you for bringing these stories to life and all 9 installments. I wish you well for future casting endeavors as well.
Thank you.
Magic Theater is located in the Marina District of San Francisco at the historic Fort Mason Center for Arts and Cultural Performances. Are Tuesday through Sunday through the 21st of this month. Mafoniso Udofio, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Is replaceable.
You gotta take it.
That's from the trailer to the show Time Sensitive. From Oakland-based theater company Ragged Wing, I'm pleased to be joined by artistic director Amy Sass, who wrote and directs the original new play Time Sensitive, a fantastical tale that combines clockwork choreography, rhythmic fugue, and melting ice art in collaboration with climate artist Carter Brooks. Time Sensitive opens tomorrow and runs through May 4th at the Flight Deck in Oakland. Amy Sass is the co-founder and artistic director of Ragged Wing Ensemble and has been involved in every company production and program since its inception in 2004. She's a resident playwright for Playwrights Playground and has won the People's Choice Award twice for her short plays and the June Ann Baker Award Commission. Her plays, installations, and artistic events feature a unique blend of visual design, unpredictable characters, and poetic language. She is the writer and director of Time Sensitive. Welcome to Open Air.
Thank you.
Of course. She's joined by Carter Brooks, the ice designer for Time Sensitive, not a usual credit one sees for plays. Carter is an artist and philosopher of climate art whose work explores how humanity and civilization will evolve in a rapidly changing world. Carter's installations of melting ice have been featured at numerous events and festivals, including the San Francisco Green Film Festival, among many others. Carter was selected as one of the first 50 presenters of Al Gore's Climate Reality Project. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Well, Amy, can you give me a little synopsis of Time Sensitive before we get into the ice sculptor?
So if you imagine a city that has taken over the entire world, so if the world was completely urbanized and the city time ruled all time, and so then the natural times of tides and seasons and growing things is all been overrun by a kind of urban accelerated clock, that is the setting and the world of this play. Yeah.
And what sort of cast is involved then?
So our characters involve a clockmaker who is bent on preserving the last remnants of natural time in these nature-oriented clocks that he is keeping, a clockwork kid that he invents to keep all the clocks synchronized, and a host of characters from the city that are stationed at different levels of status. So we have somebody who's at the very, very top, literally and economically, who is literally at the very top of the tallest tower of the city and owns all the towers, right? And we have somebody who, two characters who, Roach and Penny, who exist in the cracks of the street. And we have Tilly, who is the floor, who works on floor three of the tallest building and is trying to get up to floor four. So there is a large component of time is literally up and status is literally vertical.
And struggle and... Yes, indeed. I'm already getting some wonderful visuals of what I might see when I come to see Time Sensitive. I'm sensing maybe a steampunk vibe.
Yeah, there are elements of that for sure. Yeah, so we have a lot of fun with clockwork elements, definitely, and fun. We have these enhanced humans that are called replacements. So yes, we've had some fun excitement with technology.
And when did you first come across Carter Brooks' work, or how did this collaboration start?
Yeah, this is a really interesting one. So when we when I first started coming up with the ideas for the show, I was thinking about macro time, and I was thinking about like geologic time, and having a piece combine both this macro idea of time as it exists sort of in like Earth time, and then also micro moments, so the heartbeat or the melting of a single ice cube. And I came across, I was at the Art and Nature Festival, rolling around in the woods, kind of walking through a bunch of, it was a festival of art, and I saw these beautiful pieces of ice that were stationed throughout the forest, and you got to touch them and they would drip. And I was very affected. I thought, oh my gosh, this is just kind of like the play that I'm writing. And then I went to a strange party and met Carter, and I was like, oh my gosh, I think you're the Iceman. And he was like, I am the Iceman.
I cometh.
Never heard that before.
Sure.
And I said, would you like to be an ice designer? And he said, I don't know what that is. And I said, neither do I. Let's find out. And so we started a conversation. This was before the play was written. So a lot of the writing of the play and the notions about ice as the holding the memory of the earth came out of conversations with Carter.
That sounds about right, Carter?
That sounds about right. Yeah. It's been amazing to see how some of the ideas that we talked about and that were core to my philosophical approach to things have made it into the play. Mm-hmm. How do you hold an eon of time in your mind and be present while you're changing your daughter's diaper, at the same time. So it's, holding different time scales simultaneously, and that's a big theme of the play. And then being able to take the aesthetics of ice and put them into a theatrical environment has been fantastic too. So
just how much ice are we talking about here? How much ice is sacrificed in each play?
Oh, that's a good question. What do you think, Carter?
Each play? Well, the ice, it takes some time for ice to melt. So, you know, the ice lasts through, you know, more than one performance. But we have a lot more ice in this run than the first run. There's these huge 50-pound blocks. There's smaller blocks that the actors carry. How would we quantify it? I'm not sure.
And so tell us a little bit about the venue of the flight deck. I'm not
sure.
So familiar with that.
Yeah, so the flight deck exists in downtown Oakland. It's the only black box theater in Oakland. Ragged Wing Ensemble created and has been hosting and running the flight deck since, 2014. And so this is our fifth year having opened that venue. And we run it for ourselves, but we also run it for dozens of Oakland-based arts organizations, and about thousands of audiences come through that door every year. So it's quite a mecca for that area of artistic action. The interesting thing about the venue in relation to the show is that we have created a collaboration with Oakland School for the Arts through their production management teacher, Jean-Francois Revon, and he and his students have designed an art installation and an immersive environment for us to perform in. So the whole, you walk into the theater and it doesn't look like a theater. It looks like some kind of strange sculptural seating arrangement, and you are sat among the ice and among the sculpture, and the performance takes place in and around you.
Sounds fascinating. We heard a touch of the music that's being used. Tell us more about the soundtrack that will be accompanying.
Sure, yeah. So the soundtrack was created by Laura and Sarah, who runs Samavesha. She specializes in creating music from really interesting instruments from all over the world. And this Depachem song was something that came up as we were workshopping elements of the piece before the script was set. The cast was asked to create an ice ritual, and Carter brought a bunch of ice, and we did a procession. And one of the cast members had this song that her grandfather used to sing her, and so the cast started singing the song, and I was like, I think that's the opening of the show, and that's how that emerged, and thus became the characters of the ice monks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So overall, a dystopian worldview, or
yes.
Is there a happy ending?
Well, that's very interesting. That's a great question. There is a hopeful ending, but it is a tenuous, fragile hope. So that's what I would say. It is not. It's not like it's not a tragedy, but there is no ultimate solution except connection. And we as humans are in charge of how and when we are able to actually connect with one another. And there's a lot about moving so quickly through time and space and rush, rush, rush that we don't actually connect. We don't connect with ourselves, our environment, or one another. And so we get to see throughout the play what happens because of that disconnect, and then how characters find their way back to connection. Mm. And sometimes that's tragic, and sometimes that's comic, everything in between.
I'm glad we could connect at least a little bit about this incredibly intriguing production of Time Sensitive. Amy Sass writes and directs Time Sensitive. Carter Brooks, the ice designer for Time Sensitive. Thanks for coming in today. The productions will be through May 4th at the Flight Deck, which is at 1540 Broadway in Oakland. For more information, visit raggedwing.org. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come here on Open Air, a talk with Alonzo King and Vanessa Ng Van Vo about her work with Vietnamese traditional music, along with the Alonzo King's Lines Ballet. We'll be talking with Brett Strader about the Sing for America benefit concert happening this coming Sunday. And, the San Francisco International Film Festival is getting underway. Some 163 films will be screened by the time the festival concludes on April 23rd, including 12 world premieres, 72 films directed by women in 36 languages from 52 countries. It's the longest-running film festival in the Americas, believe it or not. Festivities get underway next Wednesday, the 10th, at the Castro Theater with the screening of the new Netflix interpretation of the iconic Tales of the City by Armistead Maupin. And instead of trying to distill the entire festival in this brief segment of Open Air, we thought we'd concentrate on one of the films, The Seer and the Unseen, by award-winning documentary director and producer Sarah Dosa, which screens next Saturday, April 13th. Sarah Dosa joins me in studio, along with Rachel Rosen, director of programming at SF Film, to talk about this film and the festival. Sarah Dosa has worked as a producer on a variety of documentaries. She is also a director of The Last Season, her directorial debut, which was the winner of the 2014 festival's Golden Gate Award for Best Bay Area Documentary. She also recently directed an episode of the Netflix music docu-series Remastered about Johnny Cash's 1970 concert for Richard Nixon. The Seer and the Unseen is her third feature as a director. She was recently named by Doc NYC as one of the 40 under 40 working in documentary film. And with a joint master's in anthropology and international development economics from the London School of Economics, she brings a unique perspective to her film work. Welcome to you, Sarah.
Thanks so much for having me.
And, of course, Rachel Rosen, you're an old hand at this now, and previously working on the film scene down in L.A. With this being such a prestige festival, can you give us just a brief insight into the screening process for how films get involved in the festival?
Sure. Well, I would say that we have a small but very dedicated programming staff, and we spend our year acting as, like you'd use almost any metaphor, detectives, fishermen. We spend our time talking to filmmakers, talking to producers, seeing what's showing at other festivals, reading Kickstarter about films that are in production, and just basically keeping track of as many films as we can. And at the same time, we have a call for entries that brings in usually between 2,000 and 3,000 movies to be looked at. Many of those are shorts, but still, it's a lot of movies. And then we just start sifting through what comes to us and assembling this festival, which the main idea of it is just to bring the best of cinema of the world to Bay Area audiences.
Mm-hmm. We're going to, fortunately, here on KLW, we're big supporters of the festival, and we're going to have a full hour of information about the festival on our City Visions program this coming Monday evening. And I believe Rose Aguilar, for your call, is going to dedicate a program to the full film festival. So it's happy that we can concentrate on one film today with Sarah Dosa. So, The Seer and the Unseen, though it's a documentary, delves into the fantastical. Tell us about how you first heard about the elves and trolls of Iceland, but also why you thought it was worth making a film about.
Sure. So briefly, the film The Seer and the Unseen is about invisible elves, financial markets, and the power of belief. But it's told through the story of this one heroic woman, a charismatic grandmother named Raka Jonsdottir. I've known her for 5 years now, and I will still not pronounce her name correctly. It's really about her story. She is kind of she's a seer. She sees the invisible realm of elves, gnomes, trolls, dwarves, and fairies that inhabit Iceland's landscapes.
It's interesting. I just learned that a 2008 University of Iceland study reported that 54% of Icelanders believe that elves do or are likely to exist.
They do, yes. And it's such a pervasive belief that you see evidence of elves in city policy, for example. Construction workers are very frequently asked to move their operations because a development project might destroy an elf habitat. And so that's really kind of where our story takes place amid one of these conflicts.
Well, that's interesting because, you can think of it in parallel cultures as well, feng shui, about the design of buildings in certain ways and the belief in God, for that matter. You believe in elves? I believe in God,
Exactly. It's quite a universal belief. And that's actually been one of the joys of this project is once we start talking about it, people will say, my family's from Hawaii. We have the Menahuni, who are also small, mischievous spirits of nature who like to mess with people.
Of course, we go to Ireland as well.
Exactly. But I think whenever people can really sense the power of nature and just how alive it is, you get these animistic narratives and beliefs in an invisible world.
So you're telling the story of this woman.
Yes, we're telling the story of Raka. The story finds her. She's a grandmother. She's an artist. She's kind of going about her daily lives when all of a sudden in October 2012, the elves summon her. They tell her that there is this lava field. It's a sacred place that is about to be destroyed. And they enlist her to save it. Fast forward a year later, turns out that indeed this lava field is going to be destroyed by a completely irrational, needless road construction project. That is pretty much just a symbol of Iceland recovering from the economic collapse that totally destroyed the country in 2008. And so the film kind of follows Raka. She's trying to protect this lava field. And the film kind of falls back in time to explore the economic forces that mobilized to allow for Iceland to be one of the richest nations most quickly. And then their spectacular collapse in 2008. So that's the little summary.
A couple of different belief systems going on there in terms of the economic faux belief system as well.
Exactly. The thing that got me so interested, actually, in the economic component was the dogmatic embrace of the quote-unquote invisible hand of the free market, which drove Iceland's policies. Kind of these competing ideas of the invisible, be it the invisible spirits of nature, the elves, or the invisible hand of the free market, and just the power of belief, this belief that all of this money flooded Iceland, that could build a country. There was an element of myth there that was really intriguing, and so we kind of explore that through Raka's story.
Mm-hmm. And your background in anthropology, I'm sure, came into play in terms of being intrigued by the whole matter.
It did, yes. I just think anthropology is such an interesting framework for exploring culture and belief, and be it the belief in invisible elves or the belief in economics. So I was grateful to kind of bring that experience and training to bear when making this film.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Rachel, we're going to be hearing a lot more about the film festival, as I mentioned, on KLW in the days and weeks ahead. We look forward to hearing more. Just tell us briefly about some of the other documentaries that are in store.
We have such a great range of documentaries. I really feel like it's a golden era of nonfiction. So... But not just this era. For example, we're giving an award to a wonderful documentary filmmaker named Madeline Anderson, who is too little known. She's now in her 90s, but she was the first African-American woman to direct a documentary that was syndicated nationally on television, one of the first black women in the editors union. She made a really amazing short documentary that we're showing called I Am Somebody, about a nurses' strike. And it features, for example, a female voiceover narration, which was very unusual at the time. And this is a woman who grew up in a time when there were no African American documentary filmmakers. She decided she wanted to do this. And she went out and made a career for herself. And she'll be here where she's going to be interviewed on stage by our local documentarian, Dawn Porter. So that's going to be an amazing program. But we also have just a great slew of political documentaries like Knock Down the House that was recently at the Sundance Film Festival. Films about art and culture, and just a wonderful array of biographical films. So a wonderful film about Molly Ivins, the reporter.
Oh, she's wonderful, yeah.
Yeah, she has a comeback for every single situation, and they're so delightful. It's really wonderful to spend time with her. We have a great documentary about Miles Davis, Dr. Ruth, who I think of as you come to realize she's like a radical activist in a certain way, and also another delightful person to spend time with.
Mm. Well, all the information of these films and plan your weeks ahead for the film festival at sffilm.org. Rachel Rosen, thanks for coming in. Sarah Dosa, as you as well. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
The Seer and the Unseen by award-winning documentary director and producer Sarah Dosa screens next Saturday, April 13th. Is that right? Yes, Saturday, April 13th. Information at sffilm.org. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, chances are that if you are a KALW listener, you're a regular donor to causes and charities that you hold dear. Well, if you have a bit of singing in your background, there's a way for you to both raise your voice and raise funds for that charity by participating in the Sing for America chorus. The SFA Foundation is now in its eighth season and has raised nearly $1 million for worthy causes since its founding. This year's Sing for America concert takes place this Sunday at the Palace of the Fine Arts Theater and will not only feature a full How Many Strong chorus?
About 100 singers.
100 singers, but full orchestra and guest artists this year that include the great operatic diva Debbie Voigt, whose career was greatly aided by her involvement with the Marilla Opera Program here in San Francisco. And here to share further details about the concert is conductor Brett Strader. Brett is the founding artistic director of the Sing for America Foundation in San Francisco, a community chorus that empowers participants to raise funds for their chosen charities through participation over a 10-week rehearsal period. Each season culminates with a gala concert at the Palace of Fine Arts Theater, featuring the chorus and world-class guest artists now in its eighth season. Wonderful to have Brett here. Brett is also director of worship and music at Lafayette Orinda Presbyterian Church, where he oversees a large department of adult choirs, a graded children's choir program, a handbell choir, band, and various vocal ensembles. His original choral and compositions, orchestral as well, and arrangements have been heard worldwide. Accomplished pianist as well. Very busy, needless to say. Brett, thanks for taking a little time for talking about Sing for America today. Welcome.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So eighth season already of Sing for America.
It's hard to believe.
We have to give a shout out to founder Eric Stratman, of course, for getting the whole thing rolling. What was his general idea to make money for these other causes rather than just put on a concert?
Yeah, about 10 years ago or so, Eric pulled me and a couple of our friends together, and he had this idea to take there's another organization that you may know of that helps people learn how to run marathons and triathlons. And so they sign up to raise money for a particular organization, and they get training and everything they need to accomplish that. So his idea was, instead of running marathons, what if you joined a chorus and learned how to sing and elevated your ability to sing great works and also sing popular music and just also have a really great time? So we started this like 8 years ago, and our first concert was at the Herbst Theater. We had about 60 singers. We were too large for that space, and so after that first year, we looked for another space, and the Palace of Fine Arts has been our home since.
And how do you assemble the orchestra for this and manage to get such heavyweights like Debbie Voigt?
Well, the orchestra is made up of contracted and volunteer players that either are my friends or are my list of instrumentalists.
And your Rolodex or
yep.
Virtual Rolodex.
Yes. And the guest artists, it's just networking. We have a lot of friends. The first year, we pulled in some favors from some Broadway stars. A Tony Award-winning star came and was one of our first great guest artists. And the word gets around, and some of our singers have friends. In this case, Debbie Voigt's a friend of Buffy Baggett, who's one of our staff and also one of our professional singers in the ensemble.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. So tell us how this works. And not today, but I have a singing voice.
Yeah.
And I barely have a speaking voice today. But I would ask friends to donate to my personal page, so to speak, for Sing for America. How does that?
Yeah, so when you join the chorus, you are provided a page on our website through another organization that helps us raise the funds. And the idea is you create your story and you choose a charity. And the charity can be anything that's a nonprofit. Most of our participants will raise money for arts-based nonprofits, but some of them will raise money for everything from church choirs to education programs. It really doesn't matter as long as they're a nonprofit. So then they have a page on our site, and then they use the power of social media, and they get donations from $5 to $25 to $500, and it's basically just reaching out to your friends and asking them to contribute.
Tell us what's on the program Sunday.
Oh, it's probably the most diverse program that we've ever done. It's sort of crazy if you can think about it this way. We have everything from O Fortuna from Carmina Burana, which is big and dramatic and classical sort of, to Dolly Parton's hit Jolene. And it kind of ranges everything in between there. I've really never seen a program that that reaches so many interests as we put on.
Something for everyone.
Something for everyone, yeah.
including Randy Bass's Gloria, which we're going to go out with. The music, incredible choral composer, arranger.
Yeah, Randy's a dear friend of mine, and I've conducted this hundreds of times with church choirs. It's kind of a funny background to us choosing this piece. The theme this year is Name That Tune, and so all of the songs, almost all the songs on our program, have a name in the title. But this is a Gloria, which is, you know, from the Mass, and it's often done at Christmas time. But it's a really great piece for amateurs to learn, and it takes them from being sort of amateur level singers to sort of professional level singers. And I thought, well, it's called Gloria. Gloria is a name, so that's my little musicology insider joke. Uh-huh. So we play fast and loose with our themes a little bit.
Randall Bass's Gloria as part of the Sing for America Chorus Concert. This coming Sunday evening, singforamerica.org for more information. Brett, thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you.
That's the sound of the Dan Bao, a traditional Vietnamese instrument also known as the monochord that will be one of the instruments used by Van Anh, also known as Vanessa Vo, to accompany the dancers of the Alonzo King's Lines Ballet performances. Earlier this week, I had the wonderful opportunity to see the gifted dancers of the Alonzo King's Lines Ballet in practice at their studios on 7th Street. As is expected of an Alonzo King presentation, the dancers are busy. These are extremely, almost acrobatic ballet moves combined with a modern dance sensibility. And their spring 2019 season springs forth on the 12th through the 21st at the Yerba Buena Center. These performances are a unique collaboration with choreographer Alonzo King and Emmy Award-winning Vietnamese musician and composer Van Anh Vanessa Vo, who collaborate for the first time to create a new work that draws from global traditions and pushes the boundaries of their respective disciplines. Since 1982, Alonzo King Lines Ballet has collaborated with noted composers, musicians, and visual artists from around the world to create performances that alter the way we look at ballet today. The company is guided by a unique artistic vision that adheres to the classical form, the linear, mathematical, and geometrical principles that are deeply rooted in the pre-existing East-West continuum. Alonzo King has been honored by the dance world's most prestigious institutions for his impact on the cultural fabric of the company's home in San Francisco, as well as nationally and internationally, for more than 3 decades. Emmy Award-winning composer Van Anh Vanessa Vo is known for bringing Vietnamese traditional music to a wider audience through new collaborations and approaches with notable performances in 14 countries, as well as at Carnegie Hall, Zellerbach Hall, Lincoln Center, the Kennedy Center, and the White House, being the first Vietnamese artist to be invited to play there by President Obama. I caught up with choreographer and musician during a break from their rehearsal. Bear in mind, this is a field recording, and you'll be treated to atmospheric peripheral sounds from nearby rehearsals, hallways, and streets. Alonzo Van Anh, welcome back to Open Air.
Glad to be here.
Very nice to be here.
Alonzo, I think there's a great deal of an improvisatory nature to Van Anh's music, but there seems to be a great deal of precision involved in the dancing. I'm wondering if the music is informing or completing the dance, or whether there are certain points that you need to make sure your dancers hit in Van Anh's music.
I think that one of the fears when you're working with live musicians is you don't want their music to die to accommodate you. You know, the choreography. You want the music to live and be musical. Because so often a composer or a conductor is so tied to the dancer that the music can die. And so the first priority, the prerequisite, is that the music is living. in that there are accommodations because we're married. And when we're married, there is a compromise. There's giving and taking. But I have to underscore repeatedly that the music cannot sound dead. It has to be musical. And we are in a relationship of dialogue because Vanang is also dancing, and the dancers are also making music. You have to move to make sound, and you have to dance to be musical. And so between the world of rhythm and melody, we come into unison.
Van Ein, you're using several traditional Vietnamese instruments, which I understand that some of which you've adapted so you can play with other Western instruments in terms of tuning, none of which will probably be familiar to most people coming to the ballet. So tell us a little bit about the instruments that you've chosen to use for this particular work.
Yes, so for this work, up to now, I have three instruments. One is a Vietnamese dan chang. It's a zither, just like the koto or from Japan, guqing from China, or the kayagum from Korea. So dan chang is one of the family member. But just like us, when we depart to different stage or even different country, we start to pick up the, you know, adapt to the culture. And then so we become the native of the new land that we come. So Dan Chang was from the same family, but when it arrived to Vietnam, it speaks Vietnamese. So we use a lot of left hand to really creates a tone, and even the rhythm and even the dance that Alonso just mentioned, so that we can change all the ornaments and the soul of Vietnamese music. And then another instrument I have is
Before you go on, the dan chang, I notice, looks rather like from the family of non-Western instruments, along with, you said it's zither-like, but also like the koto in Japan.
Yes, exactly. But it's exactly look like horizontal like that, and has a lot of strings, and we use right hand to pluck just like that. Or you can even think of the very far relative is the Western harp, but the Western harp is vertical and we play horizontal. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then the dan bao, is it called? Also called the monochord.
Yes, the dan bao is a monochord. It just has one string, and it has, if you see that on my left hand, I will have a stick up, and I use it to bend the note, or it's just like the whammy bar, but our whammy bar, that stick can bend seamlessly 2.5 octave up and down. Yeah, and I can do like that all day long, and it's just like the human voice. Yeah.
And is the
there's one thing she omitted, her human voice. She's also singing beautifully. Yeah.
Well, in a combination of the instruments, there's a combination of pre-recorded sound as well as live music. And then not only your singing, but also spoken word. Tell us a bit about both the spoken word and the singing that you'll be doing.
Yeah, so, you know, when I start to work with Alonso, the only thing I think great artists always ask me that question, that he asked me to bring something that deepens from my heart, something that it really, you know, beautiful. And then that all he told me, and I was quite worried because I have never wrote any music for ballet, and the language of ballet is also very new to me too. But anyway, so I just, you know, I start to write because I think that what Alonso wants is maybe just keep it most natural, and then something that I have never had the opportunity to share. Now is the time that for me to share. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a number of pieces. I shared with Alonso. We went back, and then we, you know, like, and then I really appreciate the fact that Alonso always asks me if we have a change. He wants to make sure that I feel still musically. I don't do it for the dance. And he always give me the priority to say yes or no. So my music still very flow very much like musically. And then for the, you know, because there's only me would be in the performance. So many musics that I wrote actually for harp, for example, and obviously I don't play harp. And I play percussion, but there's a number of tracks that I create with number of different percussion play on top of each other. So I had to do that. So, and then the spoken word came especially for the movement Floating Field. It's actually from, I got the inspiration from a short story from one of the, right now the most popular short story writer from Vietnam, Nguyễn Ngọc Tư. And she wrote the story and translated with the title in English as Floating Field to talk about the two sister and brother. And their life is always on a small makeshift boat that they just floating from one part of the town to the other part in Mekong Delta River, and their main job is to take care, you know, to raise ducks. And her father was a very good-hearted man, but love broken his heart. Their mom left them when they were very young, you know. So life in you know, in that kind of situation is really hard for the kids growing up, and you know. So they met a lot of you know, people just like floating through their own life while they are floating. So after I wrote, after I read that story, I ended up wrote Floating Field, mm-hmm. Yeah, and that I read a short part that I felt that it is the part that really spoke for the whole story in a way, yeah. And then other songs that I sang was either vocal, just, you know, vocals that how I feel when I see the other dancers dance, and then I improvise right there. Or I sang a lullaby. That's a lullaby from Star Wars, Vietnam. I wrote that. I named it Sorrow. It is a little bit long. I don't know. The inspiration from that. Okay, briefly is that 99% of Vietnamese here in America came from South of Vietnam. They came here after to avoid the consequences of war, the Vietnam War, which we call the American War in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So around 2,500,000 of Vietnamese left the country by boat.
Sure.
Yeah, and then about 500,000 of them died at sea, either, you name it, storm, starvation, pirate, and many of that. So Sorrow was, I composed Sorrows after I interviewed a couple of Vietnamese boat people who had two young daughters, and they had to leave Vietnam at the time. And their boat was captured by the pirate twice. First time they took all the valuable things. The second time they took all the women. So after they were rescued, she was one of the only three women who dared to testify in front of the United Nations. So so that's why Sorrow was, you know, inspired, and I wrote about that. And in the, you know, I combine also Western instrument, and instrument from other country like the sansula, you know, to create all the feeling. I think music is, you can play very high technical music, but if it doesn't touch the heart, it doesn't touch the heart, it doesn't matter anymore. So when I work on that, I see that how it matter how much it's important that for Alonso and for the other dancers that something has to touch hearts. So I find all different ways we care for a little small sound that, you know, something unique, but not, you know, it has to speak a character. That, you know, that how I love working with Alonso in that way, and he's look at the music very different.
So like Alonso, you're really taking something traditional and making something entirely new, not just offering recitation of folk songs or folk tales. It's wonderful.
Yes, I think when we start working, Alonso gives me a very, you know, open field for me to go. And he absolutely will not ask me to, as a composer, I have to write like Westerns. Yeah, he looks for something honest. He looking for something that touches hearts.
Well, that brings us to Alonzo King, Lines Ballet since 1982, an accomplishment in itself, to say the least, with a mission statement to renew and transcend traditional ballet.
I think it's the history of humankind, in that you begin with something and then it has to continue to expand. It has to explore. There is this idea that there wasn't an exchange of cultures when the world, that's what they've been doing since day one. You know, we credit, you know, we rave about pasta, but where did pasta come from? It came from China, you know, via Marco Polo. And there's all these exchanges which are not delineated, but they're there. In the same way that Buddhism traveled, that Hinduism traveled, that Christianity traveled, so did ideas, so did cultures, as well as spices and materials. So that idea of an isolated continent is really not true. In terms of ancient truths, there's a quote that there is nothing as old or new as the truth. And so what you want to do is to plummet into truth. Truth can be a billion different variations, but it's still truth. And so what someone shouldn't do, I'm talking about shouldn'ts now, because you can be well rewarded for being a copy, a knockoff, an imitation. And if you are rewarded for that, you've killed yourself. Because what's interesting about you is you. What's interesting about the uniqueness of the individual is what is in them that is not in anyone else. Each person is created with a uniqueness, and that has to be their offering. In the same way, no country that exists on the planet has all the answers. Nobody. And that's why we need each other, because we want to bring the best of every country to the table in the same way we should, and we want to bring the best of every artist to a construction. And so you're looking for the most refined, the most thought out, what rings true to the heart and to the mind. It's a balancing act. With an artist, you have a vision and you go with it, you follow it through. At some point, you have to have the balance of not only your intuition, but examining with introspection, is this real gold or fake gold? Because without that second look, without the introspection about the quality or idea of something, you become an egomaniac. It can't just be your interpretation of the world. It has to be, is there verity in this statement? Because in essence, Van Ung is writing essays. She's writing treatises, and the same thing with the ballet. Those are thought structures. And so you contemplate them, you experience them, you may disagree with them, but they have to be based in truth.
Sounds like you found a great partnership in Van Ein, and we look forward to seeing what the results of this terrific partnership will be on the stage.
I feel incredibly fortunate to work with Van Ein. It's a real pleasure and joy.
This is a very much same with me. I feel like my music, my culture is really honored in the most honest way. And then I feel like I'd be able to share, to build, to contribute, and to make this become better and better every day.
Linesballet.org for more information about Alonzo King and Vanessa Vo's collaboration. That's Open Air for this week. I'm glad I had a voice to complete the hour. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing Open Air. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. Thanks again for listening.